All right, Kim Gordon, thanks very much. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Monday afternoon here in Chicago. The Dow is up, the sun is out, and the Inno folks are in the studio. Can't beat any of that. We'll talk to Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis about what's going on at Chicago Inno in just a second or two. Randy Schaefer will be here later. She's a digital editor at the Chicago Tribune. And Bill and Wendy were talking about the pressure to be on social media all the time in high school. And we're going to talk with her about a study that shows that some of the pressure, the anxiety of social media is actually lessened if you get rid of the like button. She'll explain that. We'll talk about roads and bridges as well. But right now, say hello to Catherine Davis and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch, guys.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Great weekend, I trust.
Yes, a
yes.
Snowy one.
Did you see in Facebook they're testing a downvote button too? So not just the like, but like in certain areas they're testing like the ability to downvote a comment. So,
like to, what do you mean to?
So basically, it would like push it down further, so you would see it less, and just vote against the comments. Kind of like,
so could anyone vote against it?
So they were testing it out. Yeah,
wow.
This was popped up in the news last week.
Interesting. Okay, well, so that if someone posts on my page, other people could vote it down.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh. That's good. We need to bring more negativity on social media. Hey, I was at my health club this weekend. I looked up and I saw a commercial. I couldn't see the volume, but it was pretty clear early on that it was for this company, the Chicago company, Songfinch. And you guys have been writing about that.
Yeah. So they're a Chicago startup, and they provide a service that lets you make personalized, one-of-a-kind songs for someone special in your life. So a friend, a significant other, and you can give it to them as a gift.
I love this idea. In fact, I think we had someone on, the CEO, and they wrote me a song.
Oh, did they?
I don't know where it is, though.
Oh, we gotta find that.
I know. Michael Heideman, I sent him a note. The former producer here, I think, has it somewhere. I love the idea of it. We've talked about it before, but just that I noticed that they were on TV shows that they're on the move.
Exactly, yeah. So they took out their first TV ad, a regional spot here, kind of covering all of the Chicagoland area. And they're doing a lot of advertising. They're doing a lot of podcast spots as well. So they find that that's been like a really effective use of their ad dollars too, that generates some interesting sales. They're up in over six figures of revenue since launching at the end of 2016. So people are paying for this.
And so it's a cool idea for people who want a song like for their wife's birthday or graduation, but also it employs songwriters who are trying to make an honest living. They can do a little dishonestly this way.
Exactly. So how it works is that the user goes online and there's two different options. One sort of has a lot of pre-recorded instrumentals and a pre-recorded chorus, and then the user answers a few questions about their loved one, and then a songwriter is matched with them, and then they write a very unique verse. The other option is to go sort of completely from scratch. So you, it's twice as much. So it's $99 and $199, and then the songwriter really does the chorus, the verse, instrumentals, everything from the ground.
What I liked was you talked to John Williamson, the CEO, and he said, yeah, we're the only one doing this, and we actually would be better with competition.
It's funny because a lot of people don't even know that a service like this exists.
Right.
So most startups would hate competition, but they actually would prefer to have a player to like just get this more known in the space, and then more people would know that it's like something that they can go out and pay for.
All right, so it's been a big big week or two for Grubhub. We talked a little bit about their deal with Yum Brands last week, but Catherine, they had a nice ruling in court in California as well.
Yeah, so a federal judge in San Francisco ruled that Grubhub delivery drivers are in fact contract workers and not official employees of the company. And so, you know, this is a ruling that we could see affect gig economy, you know, across industries. So that could affect Uber, Lyft, other gig economy
companies. So was Uber involved in something like this? Also, weren't they? Wasn't there a fight to have them recognized as employees, and they won?
Yes, we're starting to see little court cases like this sort of pop up, and I think we're not anywhere near seeing the end of this. This is by no means. I don't think the definitive ruling on this. So I think we're going to kind of see this go like move up in advance throughout the courts. But yeah, I mean, this is really interesting, right? Because as the gig economy continues to grow, as people sort of take these freelance jobs, the question of if they are a W-2 employee or a 1099 is going to come up. Some companies like Instacart, for example, are making all their employees W-2 employees. So we're kind of seeing this issue go head-to-head, but a lot of companies like Grubhub, like Uber, still want to have these contractor labels.
And the benefit, right, for them as contractors is they don't have to offer as many benefits to the workers.
It's just a cheaper way to operate. So it'll just be interesting to see how, you know, I mean, if you want to get into the gig economy, you really got to work or think about those pros and those cons.
Right,
you have
right.
work flexibility, but you don't have benefits.
Well, if you're a driver for Grubhub, though, you might be able to have all the KFC chicken you can eat, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, based on their deal from last week, Yeah, they're going to be the exclusive delivery partner of KFC and Taco Bell. Really a big move for Grubhub as it continues to kind of put its foot on the gas pedal to really lead the way when it comes to food delivery.
So what does this mean? They bought, Yum Brands bought equity in the company, right?
Right. So Yum Brands did a $200 million investment in common stock for Grubhub, and basically it's going to give Grubhub some cash to kind of execute this deal. So they are going to be the leader or the exclusive delivery partner for both KFC and Taco Bell.
Have you ever had the Taco Bell delivered to your house, Catherine?
No, but I might now.
Really?
I mean,
would
I
you?
Love Taco Bell.
Do you? It just seems to me like that's not the sort of place I would get delivery from, but I think I'm betraying my age here. I mean, I just think it's a different way to think.
I still think we are in the early days of food delivery. I think that like this is going to be the beginning of a new wave of how people decide that they're going to eat fast food, and I think that we're going to see delivery only grow from here.
Yeah, and this partnership really proves you can get anything delivered.
Right. Well, and so Yum Brands owns Pizza Hut too, right? But
right.
Pizza Hut's not part of this deal.
So Pizza Hut and Grubhub are going to be working on deals in the future, they said in the story. And you'd imagine too, because one of the Pizza Hut executives is now joining the board for
right.
Grubhub. So you imagine those two companies are going to be
okay,
getting closer.
Okay, so again, if I can sound... Now, I had Lou Malnati's last night, right? I'm not going to order Pizza Hut to be delivered. If I'm going to order delivery, I'm going to order a different pizza.
Well, I think we in Chicago are probably a little spoiled by having really good pizza.
Our choices,
around.
Too.
Yeah, exactly. Not everybody's got a Luminati's, you know, in other parts of the country. So I think that, like, for, you know, maybe some rural areas in other parts of the country, Pizza Hut might be one of your only options.
That's Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis here as well from Chicago Inno. When we come back, we're going to talk about Milkademia. That's right. You've got time to look it up. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Monday afternoon, sitting alongside the sunny Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Okay, Catherine, you wrote a story about this company called Milkademia.
Yeah.
Which I don't know what to make from just the name, but tell me, it's about macadamia milk?
Yes.
Have you ever milked a macadamia? I'm sorry, is that the first time? No, it's not the first time.
Not quite, they're not grown here.
Oh, okay.
but yeah, Milkademia is a Burr Ridge based startup, and they have made non-dairy milk from macadamia nuts. So they're sourcing all their nuts from Australia, manufacture them in New York, and they're selling it
so nut milk,
nation.
But kind of nut milk is the big thing, isn't it?
I
don't know if it's called nut milk, but alternative milk or
right.
vegan milk.
It's like rice milk, almond milk, coconut milk.
Yeah.
Still a nut.
So who are they after? Who do they want to buy this?
So generally people that, you know, are cutting dairy out of their lives, vegan people, people who are more concerned, more health conscious, people of that kind.
And it's interesting because the nuts are from Australia,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to produce it in Australia, but they couldn't get anyone to do it because they weren't convinced anyone would drink the milk?
Yeah, they didn't think that there was a market for this, but it kind of turns out there is because Milkademia, they're on track to make $5 million this year.
Wow.
They're in Whole Foods, on Amazon. They just landed a deal with Walmart in January, and it seems like people are buying it even though it's a little pricier. I mean, it's $4 to $5 for one carton, for a 32-ounce carton.
It's 32 ounces, so that's what, a half a gallon?
Mm-hmm.
Right, I know, but it's
there,
one of the boxes.
Yeah.
Now, it's an anti-inflammatory. Does that really, do you really notice that?
Well, I haven't had any,
right.
but that's what, in my reporting, that's what the CEO said.
That it's anti-inflammatory, so that's attractive as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's been about 6 weeks or so I just feel like we should talk about Tovala again.
Yeah.
Because it's a company that just keeps coming up around here. I got an Instant Pot for my birthday. Right.
So, what have you made so far?
I've made some soups. My wife was out of town this weekend. She doesn't like pot roast, so mm-hmm. I made a roast beef in there.
Okay.
Very nice. Very
yeah.
nice. Yeah. This isn't the same thing as Tovala.
So, Tovala is a little different. So, it's a countertop oven. So, think of it as sort of a steam oven, convection heat, broiling. It kind of does a bunch of different cooking methods. And they are a food startup here in the city, been launched for a couple of years, and just got a big backer behind them now. Tyson Foods has invested an undisclosed amount in them.
And we just talked about this a couple of weeks ago, how we talked about the mm-hmm. influence of food companies in Chicago, and why some of them might be here is because there's money here, and Tyson's an example of that.
Exactly, and Tyson's venture fund is based in Chicago, so they are very well aware that the Midwest is definitely like the place to be when it comes to backing startups. Tovala actually is just the third publicly announced investment that Tyson's made. They've also backed Beyond Meat and Memphis Meat, sort of the two
Beyond Meat startup. We've talked about.
Yeah, Beyond Meat is the plant-based
right.
one, and then Memphis meats being sort of the lab-grown meat.
So
Tavala really, first of all, it's their first hardware product that they've invested in publicly. So kind of interesting to see Tavala really taking off, at least with investors, and it'll kind of see if the consumers will catch up.
And nice to see Tyson, a meat company, investing in non-meat products, too.
And aside from Tavala, part of the deal there being that Tyson will get its food inside Tavala machines, and it'll be able to kind of grow there.
Okay, so, I'm sorry for repeating this, but Tavala is a high-end countertop device. My basement is filled with bread makers, and you know, and so it's sort of that. I'm sure the quality of it's very good, but you have to cook a Tavala prepared meal kit. It just seems to me like there's so many hurdles here for this to really take off.
So they do offer a meal delivery service, so you can get Tavala prepared meals, but they're not doing that exclusively. So they do open it up to non-Tavala meals. They have a whole sort of section on their website dedicated to, you know, here's how you can cook different options. Yeah, chicken you get at the store, blah, blah, blah. So they are definitely not making a total closed loop system. They do want to provide an opportunity to cook other food.
All right, let's talk salaries as well. I know there was a report came out by Hired not too long ago that showed Chicago kind of lagging when it comes to tech salaries in the country, but maybe not if you consider cost of living.
Yeah. So in Chicago, you know, we're kind of falling behind. In San Francisco, they make an average of $142,000 a year. In Seattle, it's $132,000. But here, it's just $113,000. But, you know, when you consider cost of living, I mean, it's just cheaper to live in Chicago than it is in the Bay Area or some of these other places. And so when adjusted for the cost of living, you know, the tech salary for Chicago would need to be $173,000 compared to San Francisco.
Which is better than San Francisco.
Right.
I mean, so that's not too
shabby. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of people kind of like in mid-career sort of level. After they move to the Bay Area, they come back to the Midwest. Maybe they went to college here. Maybe they grew up here. They're finding that, hey, the Bay Area and also places like Seattle are becoming not realistic for me to live in. So you're seeing a lot of what is kind of been calling the boomerang effect.
Explain for me. So among the cities they looked at were two European cities, Paris and London, and the salaries there were remarkably low if you compare Paris at 56,000 and London at 78,000, both very expensive cities. I was surprised by that.
Exactly. Yeah, I was surprised by that too. I mean, really, when you're looking at, you know, salaries, the U.S. is kind of definitely head and shoulders above. Right. I mean, even Chicago being, they did 10 U.S. cities, Chicago was like the second or third lowest. But even $113,000, I mean, hey, that's not a bad salary.
I know the European governments offer a lot of services, you know, for free and things like that. So maybe that's part of it. But also with that comes higher taxes. So I don't know too much about European salaries. I just was kind of surprised by that.
Exactly. And then there's probably also some limitations to Hired's data, too. They just started offering their services in Paris a couple of years ago. So, I don't know how big their European data is.
That's Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis. Thanks to both of you coming by. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon, Steve Bertrand here. It's 12:37. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. President Trump had a meeting at the White House earlier today with several governors, some local leaders, some mayors as well. The closest governor to Illinois was Scott Walker in Wisconsin, but they were talking about infrastructure with an idea that the president wants to boost his infrastructure plan, which he detailed, I think, first introduced in a tweet earlier today. Baruch Feigenbaum is on a phone line. He's the Assistant Director of Transportation at the Reason Foundation, and the Reason Foundation has been looking at our roads. I know you have, too, but sort of gave him a little report card and thought it'd be a good time to check in with him on that. Baruch, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's all about infrastructure, right? Or at least that's what we're told. This will be Infrastructure Week. And I don't expect many to agree on just how to fix things, but it seems like everyone agrees things need to be fixed.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And the Trump administration obviously has an infrastructure proposal, and what happens in Congress is certainly up for debate. I imagine there'll be some changes to it. But one of the things that we do about once a year is we look at the states and the quality of the roadway systems, and it's basically a report detailing which states are better than other states, and obviously you can't compare one to the other, but it's interesting to see how the money is used.
And
yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Baruch, go ahead. I interrupted you.
And I was going to say, in this year, Illinois actually ranks 28th, so yeah, middle of the pack.
I want to get to Illinois' numbers. Let's talk in general first, though. I mean, so you've been doing this every year for 10 years or so. I would imagine the answer is that the roads are getting worse, but I don't think, from what I've read, that's necessarily the case. What? Give me a national report card.
Right, and so the results are really mixed. Many states, because over the last 10 years, there's been a real focus on prioritizing maintenance, and as a result, many states have actually seen some improvements over the past 10 years, but we are seeing there's about 5 or 6 states at the bottom that do tend to have real trouble maintaining their roadways in relatively cost-effective manner. And there, the conditions certainly are getting worse.
We know about Bridgegate. I kind of had to laugh that New Jersey comes in number 50 here, and they spend, where is it now? I had it in front of me. But they spend something like $2 million per mile of state-controlled highway, and they get lousy results. That's what you're talking about when it comes to cost-effective spending.
That's correct. And New Jersey is somewhat of an outlier, which I guess we can say is a good thing, because they spend sort of orders of magnitudes more than other states in terms of their spending categories, about twice the next worst state in terms of capital funding, several times the next worst state in terms of maintenance funding. There seems to be a systematic problem in New Jersey.
Which is interesting to me because, well, I guess that's just what we would expect from New Jersey, isn't it? The governor aside, there's just a lot of trouble there when it comes to state government.
There's a lot of trouble, and it's interesting because in the worst states, politics is usually a factor.
Yeah.
You usually see someone not funding roadways, diverting the money to something else, or some other political gamesmanship that makes maintaining roadways a real problem.
Well, you've introduced politics in it. That brings us right to Springfield and Illinois. And so if Illinois is 28th, and I'm looking at the numbers, certainly an untrained eye, I see several good things here.
Yeah, Illinois actually, for a high population state, does pretty well, because even though we look at the rankings and try to make sure they're as neutral as possible, we do notice that the higher population states tend to do a little bit worse, and I think that has to do with maintaining roads in urban areas is just more expensive. So Illinois' overall ranking is pretty good. And Illinois actually does very well on certain categories. And if you look at it, some of the pavement categories, for example, rural interstate pavement condition is actually first in the country.
Right.
Urban interstate pavement condition is third. The rural arterial pavement condition is fifth. That is very good for any state, and especially a state that has as much traffic as Illinois does.
Deficient bridges, we come in seventh. I would imagine that means we're better than 43 others, right? That's not too bad.
That's very good, because a lot of the bridges in Illinois tend to be older. You look at some of the Sun Belt states, such as Texas and Arizona, those bridges are newer, tend to be easier to maintain. So seventh is a very good ranking as well.
And so this is where, I'm not a numbers guy at all, Baruch. I mean, I'm really a bad numbers guy. But I'm looking then on spending, and it says Illinois ranks 41st in total disbursements per mile and 29th in administrative disbursements per mile. So if we're ranking 41st in total disbursements per mile, that tells me that we're spending less than 40 other states, right? So, right?
Well, that's actually in this report, 1 would always be good and 50 would be bad. So 41 means you're spending more than 40 other states.
Okay.
So that's the trick. Yeah.
I knew that was too good to be true. So we're really not getting much bang for our buck. We're not spending the money very well.
Not getting much bang for the buck. There is some difference in numbers here. 29th. Actually, administrative disbursements is not bad. That's okay. Where we're seeing the heavy cost is in the capital and bridge disbursements.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if that's, resulting of any one thing, high cost perhaps, Illinois, very unionized state. Maybe that's an issue. Maybe the lack of outsourcing maintenance perhaps is an issue, but 46th is a problem.
Wyoming was the least congested state. Baruch, I don't think you needed a study for that one.
Yeah, the congestion ranking, you know, is kind of a tough one, and that's why even though Illinois is 46, I kind of cut a break because obviously with the Chicago metro area, there's going to be congestion. But you know, it is one of the factors we take into account, but it's a relatively low weighting.
All right, so the president is out with his plan today, and you look at that, you look at the needs. What do you expect? What do you think we'll be talking about a year from now?
Well, I think based on the plan, what we're going to be talking about is the states that take some initiative, use some of their own funding, and then can also tap into private sources of funding are going to be the ones that are able to improve. Because that's what it looks like are the big focus of the president's plan. He's got some money for rural areas. About 25% of the funding is for rural areas. But 50% of the funding is basically a metric-driven prioritization process. And so states that get that money are going to be states that are doing what the president wants, which seems to be reducing costs where possible, tapping into private markets, and using state and local funds.
Baruch Feigenbaum from the Reason Foundation, Assistant Director of Transportation. Baruch, great to talk to you today. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Minute, sharing the news and asking questions for small business owners. Has your week really started if you haven't had your coffee yet? Probably not, but good news. Sparrow Coffee just opened its first cafe in downtown Naperville. The chic downtown roastery poses the question for small businesses. When is the right time to expand? Well, just ask Grubhub. They did it, and they did it well. The online food service also jumped in the news cycle this week after a federal judge considered their food delivery drivers independent contractors instead of employees. Another win for that growing gig economy. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
/12:53 This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Randy Schaefer's in the studio. She's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. Have you had almond milk?
I have, yeah. I actually really like it a lot.
Okay, I'll tell Orion about that. I understand.
<Maybe don't. laughs>
I understand his point, and it does help or hurt milk producers if you name something that's their product and it's really not.
I can see that.
But I'm intrigued by the macadamia milk. We'll see about that. Okay, I was talking earlier about this Facebook. I love this study that, who did it? VoxWeb?
Yeah, VoxWeb.
To sort of reduce the stress of social media. And one of the things they want to do is get rid of, not get rid of the like button, but sort of limit who sees it, or explain that to me.
So VoxWeb is a social media app, and they recently conducted a study where they hid the likes, so the only person who could see the likes was the person who had posted something. So imagine, for context, you post a photo on Instagram, no one can see your likes except you.
Right. And so I retweeted something this morning. A friend of mine looks like he's going to get hired at Channel 9. So I retweeted it, and then, you know, you get a little rush when you see others retweet it, especially other people who you know.
Right.
And that's all chemical, right? That's all
right.
Brain science.
And, you know, alternatively, you get kind of sad when you post something and you don't get a lot of reaction on it. And everyone can see, like, oh man, like, this must be a really terrible piece of latte art because nobody likes it.
Yeah, and I didn't think of that. I mean, I sometimes will post things and I do get the rush of getting the traffic. I've never felt sort of the abandonment of not, but that's what they're talking about, right?
Right,
so
exactly.
So the idea is that, so you can still see it, you'll still know, but your friends won't know.
Right, right. And so when they conducted the study, they actually found out that it made people want to use their app more. And they saw a 25% increase in posts because people, you know, they weren't holding back for fear of people not liking their posts. So they felt a little more free to share, which
so
was really interesting.
They would share things that they might not otherwise because they didn't think it would get a lot of...
Right, exactly. So they were a little more candid, maybe a little more spontaneous, a little less calculated and, you know, algorithmic, I guess.
So this is from VoxWeb. Does this go on? Then does Facebook look at something like this?
I don't think so. Although, to be honest, none of us really ever know what Facebook is going to pull until Facebook pulls it.
Right. Hey, what's up with Snapchat? They did a redesign, and I can hear the teenagers screaming.
Yeah, kind of like none of us know what Facebook's going to do until they do it. Snapchat's kind of the same. They released a redesign this week, and the teenagers are furious.
And what did they do that was such a big deal?
They kind of restructured the app a little bit. So instead of swiping to the left to get to stories, they kind of merged them with the front page, and it's just a very big convoluted mess. Teenagers are actually striking up petitions. petitions on change.org to try to get Snapchat to revert back to the old model. And they've actually gone out of their way to find hacks. Like if you uninstall the app and reinstall it in a certain manner, you can get back to the old layout.
That's funny. I go to Snapchat only to see what my daughter posts because she's the only one I know who's on
there. She's in that market demographic. So
when I read the article, I'm like, oh, it must be different. I went to look. I'm not even on there enough to understand
the
changes.
Did your daughter notice?
I'll have to ask her.
You'll have to see. Yeah. I bet she's mad.
Randy Schaefer, the digital editor of the Chicago Tribune, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.